You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Israel's National Intelligence Agency, the Mossad, has always had an air of mystery about it. Dan Raviv, a CBS News correspondent, and Israeli newsman Yossi Melman have interviewed its major players for their new book, Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars. It's published by Levant Books, and I'm pleased to welcome Dan Raviv back to our show today.
Hello. Nice to see you again.
It's been a long time, Dan.
22 years. That's when Yossi Melman and I did our prior book on Israeli intelligence.
And it's almost as long ago as when Mossad was formed. No, not quite.
Not quite, no. That was 19... Well, the country was formed in 1948, the Mossad a few years after that. And, you know, the thing about... I was just thinking about this, Leonard, and when I was here, I think it was 1990 when that book, Every Spy a Prince, came out. People were just starting to talk. It had been super secret, and you couldn't even mention it. No address for the Mossad, no email address, no website. There is a Mossad.gov.il. They have a site now. They're recruiting. They're saying if you speak languages, you might want to join us. So things do change.
Although then they have secret groups within the Mossad.
Absolutely.
Which they deny.
Well, the truth is I think, Leonard, they don't deny it because, again, there's a website, but there's no spokesman. So they don't deny there's a unit called Kidon that we write about. It means bayonet. It's a Hebrew word. And they're the ones that we're reporting cross borders, go into enemy countries, and have gone into Iran and have assassinated at least four of the nuclear scientists.
And that means that they probably speak Farsi. Is it important for these agents to be able to speak not just Farsi, but every dialect of Arabic?
Well, as much as possible. And so this is clear. In the past, we were certainly able to get people to talk about the training of Mossad men who went into Damascus, Syria, and went to Cairo, Egypt, years ago, in the 60s, just before the Six-Day War. And one of them, the one who planted himself in Damascus, Syria, he was originally from Egypt, an Egyptian Jew, moved to Israel, so he had to retrain his accent entirely to be a Syrian and be accepted in Damascus. But he did it, and so the Israelis are way ahead when it comes to languages and culture.
And are all the agents Jewish?
No, I don't. It's a fascinating question. You see, the word agent, as you know, is someone who's not necessarily on staff but is picked up for a mission here and there. Someone who's on staff as an operative or an officer. I've never heard of a Druze or an Arab Christian Israeli, but it wouldn't surprise me. I'm not sure they're all Jewish.
Now, when Mossad was formed, what was its original mission?
David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, thought that Israel is so outnumbered and so beleaguered and so much of a David against the Goliath of the Arab world, he said, oh, well, we need to do innovative and unusual things. So mainly I would say it was about getting ready for war. There was always the feeling in Israel there's going to be a war. I mean, and as Israelis would tell it, it meant the Arabs will invade us.
Well,
and
the
so
war
getting ready for it.
Well, peace had never been declared.
There's no permanent border for Israel. I mean, it's part of the psyche, the way Israelis think about themselves as still being surrounded and outnumbered, even today. Whereas the truth is that when it comes to the Air Force, the missile strength, the secret nuclear arsenal, and the cyber warfare capabilities, Israel is the Goliath in the region now, even though, you know, by size and population, Israel's only 6 million people. It's small.
Does Israel recognize itself as the Goliath, or does it still have that beleaguered sensibility?
Depends who you talk to, and I think that the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, when he gives speeches, for instance, bringing up the memories of the Holocaust, he is again saying that Jews are in a vulnerable position and never again should they be. Therefore, Iran can't have a nuclear bomb. So it affects politics. So some of the leading Israelis still feel that their country is beleaguered and tiny.
Let's talk a bit about the history of Mossad. Who was Amos Manor?
Amos Manor was, in fact, the leader for many years of the domestic security agency, Shin Bet. Mm-hmm. That stands for Security Services.
So it's the equivalent of the FBI and the CIA, Shin Bet
It's the FBI. I would say it's the equivalent of the FBI because we showed... the Mossad being like the CIA.
Or MI5 and MI6.
MI5 and MI6, very much set up on those lines by Prime Minister Ben-Gurion. So Shin Bet was looking for traitors within Israel. I would call that, by the way, Leonard, almost a Soviet mentality, that Prime Minister Ben-Gurion in 48 and in the 50s, they were always on the lookout for probably the Arabs and the Soviet bloc want to penetrate us. And there were so many Jews moving in from Eastern Europe that Amos Manor's specialty was finding spies from the Soviet Union and other communist countries, and then usually getting information and passing it on to the U.S., and that's the basis of the U.S.-Israeli link in intelligence.
So Israel realized that if it made itself invaluable to the United States and other Western countries,
yes,
that it would create a safer situation for itself.
And that's another way of understanding that when Israel feels itself to be so small and outnumbered, what are we going to do that's different from what others can do? What's the extra value? And so the Mossad and its sister agencies made a point of pleasing the CIA. Hey, here's a MiG Soviet-made jet. We got an Iraqi pilot to defect. We're going to share it with you. And Israel did.
In this country, the FBI and the CIA haven't always cooperated. Is it the same in Israel?
Not much. It has to do with personalities, and so these are very strong personalities. And in general, the prime minister has been able to ride herd over them. I can think of a major exception. There's a man who led the Mossad and really was also overseeing the Shin Bet for many years, and that's Isser Harel. And he was around for well over a decade, and a new head of the Mossad was appointed, and Meir Amit wanted to just push out all of Harel's people, Harel's beliefs. Harel was the old days, worried too much about Arabs, worried too much about Nazis who were still running around, even captured Eichmann, the Nazi war criminal in Argentina. But Meir Amit, this would be 1965, said, we got to turn the page. He wanted to modernize. So beside that, I did not come across actually that much in the way of rivalries or divisions separating the agencies.
So what does the Mossad focus on nowadays?
I would say really Iran. In fact, the focus changed.
Despite all of the other things that could be real problems?
Yeah, a real change. And by the way, if we sitting here in New York, and I think it's totally fair, look at Israel's problems and its future and how they really should make a deal with the Palestinians, go for the two-state solution that the United States favors and just about the whole world does, and really try to push the peace talks. And intelligence agencies can help because they add information and background, etc. It turns out that 10 years ago, they made a big turn and said, Iran, Iran, Iran.
That despite the fact that Israel has some dangerous neighbors, Syria, which at this moment is involved in other problems, but there's still Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza. There's the possibility of real problems with a post-Mubarak Egypt.
Yeah, and Israel's well aware of all that. And I actually have heard an Israeli involved in, I won't say which of the agencies, in one of the secret agencies who said he had spent time in the U.S., Leonard, he said, we can chew gum and walk at the same time. And so they have a lot of problems. They felt that the Egyptian border is good. President Mubarak is keeping the peace. Now they don't know. They thought Syria was okay. They hate President Assad and Assad hates Israel. But at least we understand, they said. We understand Assad. Now we don't know what the future is. And so it's true. Israel is monitoring what's happening in the post-Arab Spring situation. But where are they really concerned? Where do they think it's urgent? They would say Iran's nuclear program.
Is Israel concerned that post-Arab Spring we're seeing the rise of Islamist parties and everywhere, it seems, but Libya?
Well, there is a divide even within the Israeli government. Very smart people are members of the Israeli cabinet and their national security structure. And some think this is good. We always said that the Arabs should embrace democracy and then there will be more peace in the region. The thought that democracies don't make war on each other. That's the thought, and some people subscribe to that. There are others who worry more, and it is really a significant number of Israelis who worry all the time, and they think, oh, we don't know what's next in the Arab world. This is bad. And so there's a division.
My guest is Dan Raviv, who with Yossi Melman has written Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars. The book is published by Levant. Is Mossad totally independent in this country? There has always been a problem that the CIA at different times has tried to declare its independence and then been politicized. I've been hearing news reports about former Mossad leaders who are very critical of Bibi Netanyahu's approach to the current situation.
Right, and not just a policy disagreement. So in the past, we have found that the prime minister turns to the heads of the secret services for advice. What's your analysis? What do you think is going on in Cairo, as a prime minister should? But in the past couple of years, it's been clear that leaders of the Israeli intelligence oppose the idea of Israel attacking Iran using air force and missiles. And the message there, I think, if you read between the lines, especially from Meir Dagan, who retired at the end of 2010, about 18 months ago, and he's gone public, and he's been on CBS 60 Minutes, and he says an attack on Iran would be stupid, it would be a mistake, the retaliation would be awful. I think the real message from Dagan is that there's a lot more to do in the world of sabotage, including cyber warfare and assassinations. He says we can do a lot more, and so give us time. Meanwhile, sanctions are also pressuring Iran. I think that's the disagreement, that Netanyahu looks like he might be maybe even trigger-happy, maybe.
What about the two-state solution? Has Mossad taken a position on that?
Years ago it did. And so when there was a sense in Israel that an agreement, the Oslo Accord, had been signed with Yasser Arafat's people, and then Arafat was allowed back into the West Bank, it was an optimistic time. And even the Israeli intelligence agencies, Mossad, Shin Bet, others, were on board with that. In truth, Leonard, and I spent all of January working on this book, doing reporting on this, Israelis in general, top to bottom, are disgusted with the situation. They have no idea what comes next. Who do we talk to? And I'm not meaning to insult the Palestinians, just a fact that one faction, Arafat's old al-Fatah, runs the West Bank. Hamas runs the Gaza Strip. They have their internal divisions. Israelis are just kind of disgusted with it. They'd love to get back on the peace train, but Mossad people probably feel there's not much to do right now.
Well, it's been my sense, just from reading the polls, that the Israeli public is split almost 50-50 as to how to approach all of these
whether
things.
To make concessions, where the border should be, giving up settlements or not. I think most Israelis are not in favor of settlements when they realize that the settlements are a problem and make the U.S. government angry. But you ask the same Israelis, and if you give up settlements, is that going to solve the problem? They point to Gaza and say, we gave up the settlements. That didn't help.
You mentioned Mossad agents going into Iran. There's also the possibility that Stuxnet was a joint U.S.-Israeli project. Do we know for sure that that some of those assassinations, for example, were really carried out by Mossad agents?
Right. I feel, as a journalist who consults sources, finds out the best that I can, that I can say yes. In fact, there have been other reports, sometimes based on U.S. officials telling what they understood about the assassinations in Tehran, that they thought Israel's Mossad had hired locals. And our conclusion, and not just thinking logically based on the history, though we have that too, but really reporting, is that no, Israelis are doing it. They would not trust mercenaries, people they pay off, etc. Israelis are going in and committing the assassinations.
But since the Mossad is engaged in all of these activities secretly, doesn't it leave itself open to all sorts of conspiracy theories? I mean, there were people who claimed that 9/11 was a Mossad conspiracy.
Yeah, total nonsense, and I'd like to say that, and we have occasion even to mention it in the book, total nonsense. But everything about this, in fact, Leonard, whether it's good or bad for the intelligence agency, there's a Mossad mystique. The Mossad is blamed for stuff all over the world. And this is kind of interesting when there was that recent report that Yasser Arafat's clothing, hat, underwear had traces of radioactive polonium. A lot of the world said, oh, the Mossad must have poisoned him with polonium. Again, to the extent we can find out, the Israelis are telling us a story, our sources, that Prime Minister Sharon said no to the idea of killing Arafat. He didn't want to make a martyr out of him. So I don't think Israel poisoned him.
Although his body is being exhumed.
Oh, so maybe we'll know more. Of course, if they find traces of radioactivity, we'll get other people arguing that someone else did it. Don't forget, it was the Russian intelligence service that used that method to kill someone in London. This is an area in which rumors and conspiracy theories abound. So we're trying to cut through all of that and give you 60 years of history. That's what I'm trying to do.
Dan Raviv of CBS, Yossi Melman, an Israeli journalist, have collaborated on a book called Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars. It is about the strategies of Israel's intelligence agency, the Mossad, which are pivotal in the development of Iran's nuclear programs. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Dan Raviv, who, with Yossi Melman, has written Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, published by Levant Books. You mentioned that you'd written an earlier book about Israeli intelligence, Every Spy a Prince, The Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community. That was 22 years ago. 1990. So this is an update of it?
You might say, but 22 years later, so much changes. Not just the little things, like there's a website for the Mossad, but the big things, you know, the
like
danger.
Iran.
Yes, Iran.
The Shah was a friend of Israel to some degree.
Well,
in 1990.
No. He was gone in 79. Okay. He was gone in 79. So already there was that change. And Israel had already invaded Lebanon, 1982, but they were still, in fact, occupying southern Lebanon. So they got out of Lebanon. They tried to work on the Palestinian issue, I mean the intelligence community, and only 10 years ago they made the big change to Iran, Iran, Iran. So I thought that merited attention.
Now, your subtitle is Spies Against Armageddon.
That's the main title.
Yeah, okay. Your title is Spies Against Armageddon. That's two mistakes in about 10 seconds. Anyway, why Armageddon? Is that the way the Israelis see this war?
Right. It's not a word they use much, and so I was trying to come up with
a
concept.
Christian word.
Yes, that Americans could get around, but the idea of it, the intention is there. Israelis feel, in the intelligence community, that they are constantly pulling their country and the region back from the brink. And lately, it's the brink of war. It used to be that the Mossad and the other agencies of intelligence used to prepare for war to get ready. There'll be another war. Now they don't want to fight a war because a war could involve chemical, biological, maybe even nuclear weapons. That's Armageddon.
In your opening chapter, you describe a photo on Mayor Dagan's office wall. Mm. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. Mayor Dagan was the head of the Mossad for 8 years, and there it is on his wall, and he told all visitors, certainly CIA visitors and British intelligence visitors, that's my grandfather. They'd say, what are you talking about? Well, it's a black and white picture of a Jewish man, plainly, with a prayer shawl over his shoulders, on his knees, surrounded by Nazi soldiers. So the man's being humiliated at gunpoint. And you sort of think it's just allegorical. He doesn't mean it. Is it really his grandfather? And yes, press a little harder. We tell the story in our book. Yes, his family went back. It's Dagan's grandfather. Dagan's father survived the war, World War II, went back to their Polish town, and a Christian neighbor gave him that photo, said, I'm sorry to tell you, that's the day your father died. And Dagan points to that and wants to underline the seriousness of what we do. It's an insight into the Israeli mentality. If we get it wrong, we're dead. That's the way they think.
Israel isn't the only country in the region concerned about Iran. Could it have some kind of cooperation with Saudi Arabia, for example?
Absolutely persuaded that's true. Now the Oslo Accord between Israel and the Palestinians actually opened the door to a lot more contact. Suddenly, Arabs, say, in the Gulf, countries like Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, felt it would be okay to be in touch with Israel. In fact, there are Israeli companies with offices in some of those Arab Gulf cities. As a result, I'm here to tell you that some of those people are intelligence agents. And they talk to each other, and they know it. And so, yes, and Saudi Arabia clearly thinks like Israel when it comes to the dangers of Iran's nuclear weapons. And so, yeah, I think the Saudis are cooperative.
A listener, Tom from Seabright, New Jersey, asks, why do the Israelis feel it's necessary to spy on the United States?
Well, they say they stopped and that they're now drawing the line between spying on the United States and espionage activities in the United States. That would mean to keep an eye on Iranians and Arabs and others in the U.S. So it's a very sensitive point, and so the Israelis say that since the arrest of Jonathan Pollard, the American who spied for Israel, he was caught in 1985. He's still in prison serving a life sentence. The Israelis apologized. We say in our book they also tried to cover up a lot of it. But they apologized to the CIA. They said it won't happen again. And so if they're spying on Arabs or potential al-Qaeda terrorists, etc., they coordinate with the U.S. The Israelis know this is red-hot sensitive. But the reason would be that the U.S. has intentions in the Middle East that Israel felt, you know, we got to know what the U.S. is planning. How close is the U.S. to Saudi Arabia and Egypt? And so the Israelis wanted to know, but they know it's red-hot sensitive now.
And should we be assured that there are no other people doing that kind of spying?
I'm not here to assure you. I wouldn't know. The thing about espionage activities, it's secret, but it's so dangerous it would be a mistake. Oh, Masha, if another American were caught, ooh, big mistake.
But it also would have undermined a situation in which you had to trust each other.
Which they didn't and pretty much don't when it comes to intelligence agencies. We have an interview with a CIA station chief in Tel Aviv in the 60s who, you know, would go to cocktail parties, and he worked at the U.S. Embassy, but every official Israeli knew he was the CIA station chief. And he said they kept secrets from him all the time, and they hoped to get him drunk, that he would spill secrets. Okay, but since 2002, the change in Israeli intelligence to focus on Iran, we're reporting that the U.S. and Israel cooperate more than ever in covert activity.
Well, some American conservatives feel that the U.S.-Israeli relationship has weakened since President Obama took office. Is that true?
My take on this, and I think my co-author Yossi Melman agrees, is that the Obama administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu's government disagree very sharply over the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They disagree about Jewish settlements, housing in those captured areas.
But hasn't every president since the settlements were created felt the same way?
Yes, that's been U.S. policy that settlements are a mistake, and the first President Bush especially really stood up against them. But George W. Bush didn't. He took Israel's side in almost everything. And so my reading is that Barack Obama wanted to be different. George W. Bush did not accomplish peace in the Middle East. There was still the danger of terrorism and Arabs who are radicalized and hate the U.S. So Obama wanted to be different. Therefore, he was hard on the Israelis when it comes to settlements in the West Bank. But Israelis who work in the intelligence and military field have told us that the relations with the U.S. when it comes to weapons, shared intelligence, covert activities together is excellent. Anti-missile systems, for instance, that help protect Israelis in southern Israel from missiles from Gaza, excellent. So it's a mix here. Obama seems to be committed to Israel's security, but disagrees over the West Bank.
Israel has also developed some of its own weapons.
Oh, yes.
Do they sell them to the United States?
Yes, when it comes to systems, electronic systems usually. They're add-ons to airplanes and rockets.
Jim from New Jersey asks if you can comment on the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty during the Six-Day War.
Right, a very sensitive point, and not everybody's going to like me saying this, but our journalism and our reporting has yielded our conclusion that when Israeli planes bombed and strafed a U.S. ship called the Liberty off the coast of Israel and Egypt during the Six-Day War, it was a mistake. Now, I know you're going to get calls even from U.S. Navy veterans who feel certain that it was not a mistake, that Israel wanted to silence and blind a U.S. spy ship. The Liberty was a spy ship working for the NSA, the National Security Agency. I don't think so. We really did interview people. And the man who was the CIA station chief at the time, whom I mentioned, John Haddon, he believes it was a mistake. So that's what we believe.
Dan Raviv is here to talk about how the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad, has changed in the past few decades and is now a major player in the anti-Iranian nuclear program. His book, written with Yossi Melman, is called Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a chapter you've called At the Front Together, you wrote about Israeli intelligence chiefs' reactions to 9/11. Mm. What did they say?
A very delicate point when we're here in Lower Manhattan, by the way, Leonard, and that is Avi Dichter, who was head of the Shin Bet, the domestic security at the time, and they're also in charge of aviation security, told us that in the years before 9/11, he frequently had told the Americans, meaning the American government, the FAA, for instance, and the airlines of the United States, you must have an Israeli system. You must check the intentions of passengers, learn how to keep an eye on them, find out when they bought the ticket, figure it out. That's how you're going to be attacked by the unexpected. And so Avi Dichter said, I don't want to say I told you so, but he did, and he says that the American airlines and the aviation community had always said it would be too expensive. So Dichter said, expensive? Look what you had to spend after 9/11, rebuilding, going to war in Afghanistan. He said it would have been much better to have tighter aviation security beforehand.
And have we followed the Israeli model since?
To a degree. In fact, in the last couple of years.
Is the reason I have to take my shoes off at the airport?
That is more closing the barn door after the horses have bolted, where it was discovered that al-Qaeda had a plot based in Britain to use liquid explosives, so therefore no liquids on planes. And Richard Reid, also based in Europe, he had explosives in his sneakers, therefore take your shoes off. The Israeli method is much more, Leonard, checking beforehand why are you traveling. We're getting toward that. You have to give your airline more information now beforehand when you're going on a foreign flight. And in the background, the TSA is trying many experimental programs to find out what your travel patterns are, whether you're a trusted traveler. And at some airports, I know at Logan Airport in Boston as a test, they're looking at you in the eyes to see if you seem to be an honest man or trying to hide something. And so that's a big change and is a move toward the Israeli system.
Now, you mentioned earlier that after he retired, Meir Dagan told the Israeli news media that if Israel were to attack Iran, it would be the stupidest thing I've ever heard. What does he suggest should be done?
A lot more sabotage, subterfuge. I mean, here's another one.
Well, Stuxnet, to some degree, was revealed. If it had been done perfectly well, the Iranians never would have found out what had gone on.
Well, you know, nothing's perfect as far as that goes, but there have been at least three major cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear program. They've been identified by foreign cyber contamination experts as Stuxnet, Duku, and Flame. I'm just betting you that there are others. I know the Israelis wanted to keep trying, and they are not doing it alone. The Israelis, it's their military intelligence, which is great at high tech. The agency is called Aman. They have Unit 8200, worked with the NSA, the Americans, in order to come up with cyber warfare. So I'm sure they're still trying. But Meir Dagan also means more assassinations, also means more targeted explosions, mysterious events. All in all, not an all-out war. He thinks that would be stupid.
But hasn't he also come to the conclusion that the Ayatollah Khamenei wouldn't resort to nuclear war?
He can't be sure. And I can't speak for Dagan. I must say that, however, people who generally agree with his view also agree with Netanyahu. From an Israeli point of view, we can't take that chance. We can't live under that shadow. Now, the U.S. point of view, Leonard, is mainly about non-proliferation. Barack Obama does not want every country in the Middle East to start pursuing a nuclear arms program in order to keep up with the Iranians. And so I think that's Mr. Obama's main concern. The Israelis say, we just can't live with Iran having a nuke, and I think Meir Dagan agrees with that part.
Although if Iran dropped a bomb on Israel, it would affect almost all the countries in the area, wouldn't it?
Sure,
because
and some
nuclear fallout,
it, out, yeah.
It would kill people in Jordan. It would kill people in Syria and Iraq.
I don't believe that Iran is likely to use the bomb, and many Israeli strategic analysts, some of them in the government, say it's not likely they'll use it. They'll use it as a new kind of blackmail weapon. Right? They may do a test explosion, Iran, and then later, if they want to achieve something, you know, hold a port in Syria or send terrorists somewhere, etc., no one will dare to challenge Iran because then it'll be a nuclear power.
Now, there's been a lot of pressure on the United States to perhaps stage a preemptive attack on Iran.
And
is that being spurred on at all by Israel?
I do think so. I really do. I think that quite intentionally, Israeli intelligence has gotten America's official attention, sending files, sending information, wanting to do more covert cooperation than ever in order to draw the U.S. in. Basically, I think it has worked. It helps explain the urgency of sanctions. It helps explain Barack Obama's public statement that he won't let Iran get a bomb.
Now, I mentioned that there is a secret unit within Mossad called Kidon. Can you tell us about it?
The word means bayonet, and these are highly trained people, and according to our information, they don't even show up at the office. They're that special that wherever their headquarters or camp is, not everyone in the Mossad even knows. They don't go to the office, and when they're seen at all, they use fake names at each other, names, colors, whatever. They don't even use their real names. They are fitter. They are more innovative, they're better trained at weapons, they're braver, more motivated than your average Mossad man or woman. Now, they were created after the Munich Olympics massacre. 40 years ago, 11 Israeli athletes were murdered in Munich, Germany, at the Olympics. Palestinian terrorists had taken them hostage. And Israel decided to get back at the Palestinian movement. They used an assassination team.
The Olympic Committee decided not to remember that, do a little memorial of that terrible attack during the current Olympics. Is that a reflection of the way the rest of the world sees Israel, do you think?
Well, the Israelis are bitter about it, and from an Israeli point of view, it's like the whole world doesn't like us. And Leonard, I don't know if you ever thought about this. I mean, your questions are perfectly fair. Anywhere I talk about this book, people are in America. In America, most people seem to like Israel, not everybody, but most seem to, and a public opinion poll show that. But the Israelis are well aware that in most countries on earth, they're seen as an evil country. And yes, Israelis assume it's anti-Semitism, it's anti-Jewish feelings. And so when they hear that the International Olympic Committee would not pause in London to remember the victims of the terrorism 40 years earlier, yes, I think many Israelis think, They hate Jews.
And none of them question that perhaps some of Israel's policies would have had an effect?
They don't say none. Israel is a very divided country, as you've pointed out, where there are, let's say, broadly speaking, there are left-wingers, or liberals, if you will, who want to give up the West Bank and want to have secure but smaller borders and want coexistence. And there are right-wingers. And so it's very divided. And some Israelis feel the world hates us, as they put it. And some don't and are more open. It's a very divided country right now. And so the Olympic Committee decision, as you say, that's a sore point.
On the other hand, every time missiles come over from Gaza and Hamas takes credit for it, don't they really encourage that kind of sensibility within Israel?
Well, I do think so. It sort of unites the Israelis in the following feeling. It's an uncomfortable one. There's no one to negotiate with. We can't work on Palestinian peace. That's not good. That's not helpful to any of us.
Now, can you tell us about the Israeli air raid against Syria in 2007?
Yeah, 5 years ago, and Israel kept it totally secret. It picked up signs that there was a mysterious building being built on a river in northeastern Syria, very remote. And Israel, by the way, has spy satellites. Yeah, small country, yet it has as many as 6 satellites at any time up there taking pictures. And so Israel noticed it, got intelligence about it. We're reporting sent operatives on the ground to remote Syria to take radioactivity readings, etc., pick up soil samples. And when they determined that North Korea had helped Syria build the beginnings of a nuclear reactor, Israel told the United States, and Prime Minister Ehud Olmert asked President George W. Bush to bomb it. He refused in June of 2007. In September, Israel's Air Force did it. Israel's never confirmed doing it, feeling it was best to just keep it a secret.
Well, what is Israel's position on the current situation in Syria?
Very confused. Truly confused. On the one hand, President Assad is the devil we know, so we know how to handle him, etc. What if al-Qaeda or Islamist radicals take over Syria? That would be bad. Many Israelis, however, are humanitarian and realize thousands of civilians have been killed. Very confused.
Just one more thing. How did you get the intelligence agencies you interviewed to talk to you?
A lot of years, a lot of trust. I was based in Israel for CBS back in the late 70s. So there's a long history there of knowing a lot of people. Yossi Melman covers it day to day for Israeli newspapers and websites. So it's like anything else, Leonard, it's who you know.
Dan Raviv and Yossi Melman, their book, Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, published by Levant. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Pleasure. Thank you, Leonard.